My second term.
What was your first term when?
I was down at Chulai. And I kept a diary faithfully, but I did not when I went back. Well, I was in a different frame of mind.
Were you irritated or?
Well, I had just went through a divorce, you know, and things were, you know, within myself were not going well, so.
Yeah, of course.
I just didn't, you know, didn't matter. Didn't seem to matter.
Yeah,
which I didn't know what I was getting into.
Yeah. Darn, it's too bad you
change.
Went without a diary the first time. Are we ready to go?
Oh, yes, we have been.
Yeah. That's fine. We
won't
use it.
Okay, we were talking about sensing devices.
Sensing devices, and were they useful? And see, one of the things that comes up, it wasn't, you know, there was some patrolling outside the base, but it's in many respects, that was the enemy's ground. And this, as far as news reports, this looked very strange.
Yeah.
And so what... You know, and however, Lowndes, I know, because I've spoken to him already, and others, we interviewed General Westmoreland, too. And their position is that they weren't sending, you know, they weren't doing a lot of patrolling because they wanted a killing ground. And that was the whole purpose of KSON, to establish a killing ground. So this is the sort of thing that the sensors and, as I said, the artillery aspects and so on that we want to get into. So how did the sensors help?
Well, it's my understanding that they planted these sensing devices around all the hills, and these sensing devices were, in fact, radio transmitters that, when a person came near them, put out a signal. And then there had people monitoring receivers in the operations center to determine when these sensors were activated, when the transmitters were activated, and this is the way that they could tell when concentrations of troops were building up in a particular area. And I don't know how these, I've heard, and I would think this would have to be the way, that these sensors were placed by aircraft, that they were dropped by aircraft and sort of seated in an area. But the night that Hill 881 was attacked, the sensing devices alerted us to the fact that the NVA were massing in that area. And a good many of our missions at night were as a result of reports from the Fire Support Coordination Center, who were in the operations center of the 26th Marines, and were getting this information from them. And they would tell us that there were troops massing in a particular area and for us to saturate the area with artillery fire. And, you know, I personally, you know, just don't know how all that worked and everything, but I know that we got a lot of leads that way, and we fired them, and a lot of times we would get reports that we had done some good in those areas by stopping attacks and what have you. You know, the one patrol that you mentioned in your paper, you know, we didn't like to see people go out because it was not our ground. It was the NVA's ground. And I mean, it's our nature to want a patrol area. I mean, we don't want it to be their ground. We want it to be our ground. And when they went out that day, this was the this was not the India Company one. This was 126. I believe it was Bravo Company. And when they went out, when a company went out of the compound, naturally we planned fires in support of them. But this was a very overcast day. There was no visibility. We could not see them from the compound. We knew they were only a short distance from the compound when they got hit, because we could hear the fire. Now, I was in the FDC. If people that were above the ground could actually hear the gunfire when they were attacked, and we fired in support of them, but We had to fire past them because we didn't know exactly where they were and we couldn't see them. We knew where they, you know, their patrol route and everything, but patrols have been known to get off their route. And we couldn't be certain that they were on their route. So we just fired some previously determined defensive fires in support of the patrol. And the FO was killed in that particular thing, so we did not have communications with an FO, and we had no direct information from the patrol to know what they were, you know, where they were and what they were doing. So we were just actually firing in the blind. We were firing around them, but not actually in support of them. And it's a very bad situation to get into like that. And that, you know, of course, you know, those things were not good for morale. Let me say that. If you lose a company like we did that day, or a platoon, I don't remember what the size of the unit was, that went out, that's very demoralizing for the troops within the compound. Death is just not a good morale factor. I mean, if you go out and have a successful patrol, right, that's good for the morale. But I don't think that it was, you know, was smart to go outside the compound. And obviously, Colonel Allen's and the other people didn't think so either, because we just didn't venture out that much. The Special Forces camp, they had people going out, but they were just going out seeking information, and they were coming back and bringing information. They're the ones that were able to tell us when they were, the NBA were getting their supplies, because we could, they could tell from the condition of the NBA whether they, you know, were eating good, what their morale was, and when their morale was good, then they were getting supplies, and they had on clean uniforms and fresh weapons and things of this nature. This was one of the times that this brings to mind was during the bombing halt, and when President Johnson ordered the bombing halt to the DMZ, we seen a definite change come over the NVA there, because while the bombing was going on, they obviously were not getting supplied well. We started getting a lot more incoming artillery and rockets during and after the bombing halt. It made a distinct difference. The AOs even noticed. They could tell they were flying close enough and would see the NVA. And at one time, most of the NVA that were reported were dirty, unkempt, you know, uniforms and shreds and things of this nature. But after the bombing halt, they were all in full uniforms with new equipment, and that made a definite difference. There were a lot of thoughts about the cessation of the bombing. You know, I knew that, you know, I didn't, that was a political move, and, you know, I just had to assume that the powers that be had a much better picture of it than I did, because we were sitting in the situation where we would receive the brunt of something of that nature, and it wasn't a pleasurable place to be at that time.
Let me ask you a couple more questions. We don't have a lot more to go. I mean, this is going real well. How about supply drops to the base? Could you describe a little bit of that?
You bet. You know, initially, after we first, after we were first attacked, they tried to land all the aircraft and unload. Of course, this drew a lot of the, and one thing I didn't mention earlier, the NVA had set up a lot of mortars right around the compound, and when a plane was in unloading, the enemy would start firing mortar fire at the aircraft, and they got a few that way. And so they decided to use parachute drops and what we call the sled drop. And both of them were very effective. They moved a battalion down on the west end of the airstrip in an area of probably a mile square and set up a defense around that area and then use that area for parachute drops and these sled drops. And and was very, very successful. I think that we probably used the sled drop, and that was either a C-130 or C-123 aircraft, which they had the rear door. And what they would do, they would load the supplies coming to us on pallets, and then the aircraft would come in very low, and then just when they would get over the drop area, they would tilt the nose of the aircraft up and go near as near straight up as they could, and then kick all of it, those pallets of supplies out into this landing area. And just really fantastic operation, because, you know, 6,000 men used one heck of a lot of supplies, and we never had a shortage of sea rations or ammunition, or the only shortages that existed during this period was water, and well, water is the only thing I can personally remember we had a shortage of. Of course, they tried right at first. They tried to keep us with fresh food, and that was. You know, that was a hell of an effort, but it was a futile one, because even if we had food, we had no place to cook it, because they blew away the galley, and it was a very dangerous operation to set up a galley and try to serve food. So I don't, you know, of course people grumbled about the fact we ate sea rations for the length of time that we ate them, but still, it was better than starving to death. And we didn't have a shortage of them. We had those things all over the place. In fact, you know, a lot of people quit eating them. You know, we were served three meals a day, and if you eat three meals a day of sea rations, after a while, it just doesn't appeal, and maybe one meal a day will do. So with a few cookies and chocolate bars and things of that nature out of the sea rations to supplement one meal a day. I know I was down to one meal a day when I left there. Just wasn't necessary, but the drops were the logistical support of that base was just unbelievable. You know, the entire arms, the supporting, you know, the air support that we got, both combat air support and logistical air support, was just unbelievable. And it just shows you know, what this country is capable of in a situation like that.
Let me ask you something. This is related to supply and other things. There's a lot of talk in the newspapers about another Dien Bien Phu. The Khe Sanh would be another Dien Bien Phu. Soldiers surrendered, in this case Marines surrendered. A symbolic battle. Perhaps even the general in charge was the same general who had been in charge of Dien Bien Phu. Was there any talk about that up at Khe Sanh?
Well, I think among the professional Marines up there, the ones that had any length of service, you know, personally, I had read books of Dien Bien Phu. In fact, when Dien Bien Phu fell is when I re-entered the Marine Corps. I had went out of the Marine Corps for a very short period of time in 1953, and Dien Bien Phu was the big element of the news at that time. And so I thought about Dien Bien Phu, although, you know, I had read of Dien Bien Phu, and I knew that the main reason for the loss of Dien Bien Phu was the fact that the French did not control the hills around Dien Bien Phu, and we did control the hills, and never at any time was there any doubt that we would lose control of those hills. You know, I think the, you know... Now, I'm not sure about this particular point, but I understand there was some mining in Dien Bien Phu where they went underneath the encampment. And at one time while we were there, we suspected, in fact, we brought in specialists, intelligence specialists from out of the compound to determine whether or not we were being undermined. And that was when there was more talk of the comparison of Dien Bien Phu than there was at the earlier part. Most of the people at Quezon were 20 years old. Now, you know, the senior officers and the senior enlisted might have given some thought of that. You know, I read more about it in the papers than I heard at Quezon about the comparison of Dien Bien Phu and Quezon. It wasn't something that was on the minds of the people there, I don't believe.
Well, this is the next logical question, and I've asked this of others. It's a combination of things. It has something to do with the morale of the troops there, faith in the chain of command, that the commanders knew what they were doing. And was there a sense that this was a big battle in Marine Corps history, and were the Marines going to do well? That was the feeling. What are we doing here? We're going to do a good job. We're doing what we're supposed to do. Or are we out in left field in a potential Dien Bien Phu situation?
No, you know, I think that, really all I can tell you is the way I thought about it and the people that discussed it with me. And, you know, we thought it was a futile. I would say the basic consensus of the people that I talked to relative to this, that it was a futile battle, but one that we were not going to concede. You know, if they had been any time came down and said, let's pull out of here and leave this place, even though that's eventually what we did, if we had have ever done it and said, you know, well, we're just going to pull out of this thing and leave, I don't think anyone there would have been happy. The way we left, I think everyone was satisfied because we felt we had defeated the North Vietnamese in that particular area and consequently could leave there and hold our heads high. You know, there was no... if we had have walked out of there at any time during, you know, before Operation Pegasus and given up the base, it would have been a defeat. And I think even the ground troop, the non-professional that was just, you know, in the service for a short period of time, I think even they felt the same way because of the way the Marine Corps teaches, the esprit de corps and what have you. I really don't feel that if given the opportunity, that people would have just left en masse upon invitation. I think they wanted to stay and see the thing through.
Okay, can I ask you, what's the funniest thing, or maybe there are a couple of funny things that happened to you up there? The humorous side of war is something that left out of the news, but it's part of the experience.
Well, there were, you know, so many. You know, I think that the humor is what gets us through wars, through battles of this nature, and you know, we just take anything and turn it around. One particular instance was one fire mission. I don't remember if I put that in the letter or not about the elephant, but we received a fire mission from a forward observer, and we sent down the mission. Elephant carrying supplies in the open will adjust, you know, and we started firing at the elephant. And I don't remember who was on duty in the FDC at the time, but the FDO order was omitted in our reply to the observer, which tells him what we're going to do once we adjust on the target. And we were firing a 155 howitzer at the elephant. And he starts, we start our adjustment, we fire adjustment, and then he says, the observer, when we've adjusted adequately on the target, he'll say fire for effect, okay? And then we come back on the air once we fire for effect and tell him firing for effect. And so we fired for effect, and the round, we fired one gun of 155 millimeter howitzer at the target, and he come back and said, you only fired one gun. And so we go back and tell him, well, you only got one elephant. And, that was very humorous to us at the time. this thing over the rockets, where the rockets were pointed at us. This was very comical. I mean, the way, you know, the observers have a lot to do with that. The way they present the information to you, and they tried to keep it light. A lot of our instances evolved around the observers, the humorous events. This gas thing, the tear gas thing, was a very humorous event. There was humor in everything. You know, we'd have all this big deal over the sea rations. You know, we'd go get rations, and you know, and everybody wanted one specific thing. Most of the time, they wanted the beanie weenies, and so there was always a big fight over who was going to get the big beanie weenies. And you know, it's one other thing too. You know, this was during the highlight of the flower children, and the troops used to love to get stuff from home and decorate their uniforms with it. In fact, it was funny, you know, the way that the people ran around like that, because I thought it was okay. You know, I mean, they were doing their job in the Marine Corps, fighting the war. But, you know, the thought of, we had some people that didn't think it was funny, that didn't think that flower child stuff was funny. We had one guy that had yellow daisies all over his flak jacket and his helmet, and he was, you know, he was that type of young man, but he was also very good at his job and everything. And our executive officer came in one day, and this young man was on watch, and the executive officer came over to me and made me go over and have this individual take all that stuff off his uniform, but that was a good morale factor. That flower stuff, you know, they loved it, you know, and it was okay. It didn't make any difference, but you had to get rid of it anyway. But no, I don't. We had humor was rampant. I mean, we did not stay depressed. You couldn't live in a situation like that if you didn't make humor. You know, everybody had their stories. You know, we had people leaving and coming back, going on R&R, coming back, and they'd always bring their stories with them. And it was not, you know, it just wasn't all that big a deal. People just went about their business and did their thing. And humor, there was a lot of humor. I just don't recall it all.
Sure.
But
can I ask you some specific things? Was there a lot of reading of Playboy magazine, that sort of thing?
Oh, you bet.
Was there the pinup, like the pinup? Well, see, I've got photos of this sort of thing, but maybe you could discuss it. Like the pinup was a, whatever you want to call it, an icon, or especially in World War II.
Well, it was here also. And of course, you know, the pinups in 1968 are not like they were in World War II. I mean, they're much more revealing, for one thing, Playboy and Penthouse and things of this nature. In fact, those created some problems at times, because some people didn't think they were proper, but everybody had them nonetheless. They were prevalent. You know, we probably had some mailed in, I don't know, but when people would go in R&R, they'd bring them back with them. And, they were very popular. But I don't think you could compare Vietnam with World War II relative to, you know, pinups and things like that. I don't think people. Of course, the pinups in World War II were on people like Betty Grable and Hedy Lamarr and people like that. In Vietnam, any nude woman would do for a pinup. So it just didn't make any difference.
Now, I have a couple of things that I've asked everybody. You know, if it's something you want to respond to, that's fine. If it's not, that's fine too. Um, Okay. When you came back and saw the war reported on TV, did you see the same war that you had seen while you were there? This is, I'm going to ask some news-related things. We're interested, as I said, about, you know, was there a slant on the war and what was left out? So you came back, you watched television, and how did it compare and contrast with your own experience as far as the war reporting is concerned?
I think, while I was over there, my mother sent me copies of the Dallas Morning News, of the articles on Vietnam and on Khe Sanh in particular. She sent me a lot of articles, and I really don't know how to respond to that. I don't think that you can present the war to the American public. Of course, since having read your paper, I can see what was presented, because I saw it also when I wasn't in Vietnam, and it's not what's there. I mean, while you're there, while you're in it, I just really don't know what was totally presented. Now, I saw on more Army stuff on the news where what was the big deal over in Happy Valley and places like that, and they showed units getting shot up pretty bad. I would say what I saw that the American public was presented a picture that would make it unpopular, that would make it, but I don't think that, while I was there, and I was over there twice, and I did not object to doing what I was doing. Of course, I was a professional Marine, and in 15 years before I went to Vietnam the first time, so I considered this my job to do this, to be there. But the people that did not, the volunteers, the people that were in for 3 years and were going back, I don't think they objected to being there. I never heard any talk about, why the hell are we here? What are we doing here? This was not a part of our conversation of any of the people there. I mean, they just accepted that they were over there for a reason, whether they liked it or not necessarily, and didn't complain about it. And I don't, almost every news event I've seen in Vietnam showed people wounded and killed, Americans wounded and killed. And that was not a daily occurrence in our position. We didn't have people killed every day. I saw the medevacs go out of there quite frequently, and I didn't like, I didn't like the part of people having to die over this, but it's just a part of war. Death is a part of war. I don't know. I know that's not responding.
Well, it's a hard question to come at, because it's all indefinite. What are the effects, and why are things left out or stressed? Is it by intention or by accident, or was the guy here rather than there? And so, how about going at it another way? When you came back, did people understand what you were doing there, or did people say, what the hell are you doing there? And, guys are always shooting up women and children, that's kind of.
Well,
I'll tell you, giving you this personal experience, I was looking for a job as a college teacher, and the vice president of a school said, "We're not going to hire you, you're a goddamn war criminal." I said, "Well, how do you figure that?" And the fact that I had just been a member of the military meant that somehow I was some sort of psychopath.
Well, I can understand that. Did you see?
But they had to get this picture somehow.
Have you seen the movie Deer Hunter?
Well, I'm going to ask you about that. Okay, but the point is that the people back here somehow were picking up an image of what we were doing there through television, through the other news vehicle.
Of course, me being a professional Marine, the people that I associated myself did not. My family, You know, when I came back to the United States, the only people I associated myself with were my family and military friends. And so I really can't evaluate, you know, how the... I never had any adverse reaction, you know, of any civilian that I met. I never had an adverse reaction to the fact that I was in the military and had been in Vietnam and things of this nature. Of course, I also was in Texas, and I don't think Texas and people in Texas are ever anti-military. I don't believe so. You know, it's we have a larger share of people in the service at all times, and so I don't think Texans. Now, you know, I was up in Indiana once, and they didn't like me in uniform then, and that was in peacetime. And they just didn't like the military. And I think that has something to do with it. Where in this country you are. And I'm sure in Vietnam, I was up there in 1957. I said they hadn't had a reserve unit shot up real bad in World War II. And they still held ill feelings towards the Marine Corps at that time in 1957. So, or no, Korea, they had it. It was shot up from Korea, so 1950 or somewhere around that time, and in 1957, they had very ill feelings towards the military, and didn't even want to see people going in. But I think, you know, where you are in the country has a lot to do with that.
That's an interesting reaction. It may be true. I want to ask you about some of the films. The Vietnam films. Have you seen The Boys? What about your reaction to The Boys and Company C?
I haven't seen one film. One film.
Okay, so let's go to that immediately.
That's
I suspect
the
that's The Deer Hunter.
That's The Deer Hunter.
Any comments on that? The point is, what will Hollywood leave out, or what's it important, I guess?
Well, The Deer Hunter, I think, was a very good film. And I think, you know, they tried to, I think they tried to compress, you know, the whole war in a very short sequel, and I think they did a good job of it. You know, they showed a lot of things. I mean, I don't know whether there were any prison camps like the ones they showed in that movie, or, you know, prisoners being treated in the manner. Now, I do know from reading Street Without Joy and other books of the French and Vietnamese that the prison camps were really bad news, but I don't know whether they actually had anything of the nature that was showed in the movie Deer Hunter. But I think that with the figure in there using compression to show all the ugliness in a short sequel, that they did a good job. And you know, of course, I think a lot of that movie was you probably understand the writing of something that a lot more than I do, the symbolism and what they're trying to say and everything. I think you pointed out good, though, the public reaction to a returning veteran. Now, he was interjected into a industrial community that, you know, don't go to fight wars. They didn't have to go fight wars. And yet he went and fought a war and came back, and people did not. And nobody can understand what a person has been through unless they've been through it. That's real simple facts, you know. And people expected him to be as he was, and you can't be. It's really that simple. If you go through a war, you cannot come back in a short period of time be what you were before you went. You know, I was a nervous wreck after coming out of Quezon, and I don't particularly have a nerve problem, never have, but I mean, you come through a situation like that where you're under constant attack, and I didn't even know my nerves were a problem until I got out of there and I got back to the United States, and all of a sudden I noticed I had a nerve problem. If I was in at home or whatever, and somebody made a little noise, I'd jump all over the place, and I couldn't even believe that.
Yeah, tell us more about that. I've asked this of everyone. I know I had dreams and things like this. Did you have dreams or weird experience? We had one guy who has been afraid to be touched from behind, you know, on the shoulder. And he's in a store one day during Christmas, and someone noticed him from behind. He turned around and knocked out the guy, and it was Santa Claus. So nothing is, I don't think anyone's going to have anything as dramatic as that, but any, when you came back, you know, what are kind of the shakeout things, either in your sleep or waking, or
well,
what you call your nerve problem, is that?
I don't recall having dreams particularly, but I do recall my nervous, I would jump a lot, and yeah, I would, I know one time I turned to one of my kids, made it, you know, dropped a spoon or a fork or something, a sharp noise, and I turned as if to hit. I didn't, but I mean, I turned as if. And I don't know. I just know, you know, I was, of course, I had other things going on in my life, too. You know, like I told you, I had, went through a divorce and everything, and I don't know how much effect, you know, that could have had on, you know, I was just a basket case when I got back States. You know, I was fine until I left there. And then when I got back States, my nerves started bothering me. And, I don't really know what the problem was. I'm sure that the strain or the relief from the strain that I had been under for so long had to have an effect. I don't think you can, I don't think you can go through something like that without having some adverse reaction to, you know, returning to a normal life. I don't think so.
Is there any special insight or, you know, attitude toward life that has come across from this experience as a, you know, result of being at Quezon? Was that a special moment, or you say you were changed to... You were nervous, more nervous when you came back. I guess that's true of everybody.
Well, of course, that was only a temporary thing.
Right.
I think I learned a lot over there, you know, about people. You know, you never know how a person's going to react until you put them in a situation. And, you know, you take, well, okay, I had 35 people working for me, but I was around a couple of hundred people. You know, we went through a lot of events that caused great mental stress on an individual, you know, to continuously go through being shelled and bombarded and the constant knowledge that, you know, you could get killed in this thing. You actually could, and some people couldn't handle that. And
what would be the reaction?
Well,
to this, they couldn't handle it.
Well, I mean, they would, well, I know for one instance, of course, this was, you know, I feel the individual's fault. You know, when I told you about those 13 people getting killed in that bunker, we had a man that evidently knew that he couldn't handle the sight of death or bloodshed in a way of that, walked over and looked in that bunker and looked at those people, and he flipped out at that moment, and he had to be evacuated because of that. I mean, you know, he became a blubbering idiot, and he sat around and cried all the time. And, you know, I'll never understand why. I mean, I know what I can handle in a sense. I know what I can handle and what I can't. I mean, if I have to handle something, I can handle it. But I certainly wouldn't have walked over and looked at those people because I knew what had happened. You know, I wouldn't have done that. I mean, if I had been required or needed to be there, I would have been there, and it would have been okay. But I mean, just to go look at something like that is, you know, that's pretty heavy. I can't handle something like that just for the sight of looking at it.
Any other long-term results, perspective on life?
Well, you know,
or your career as a military man, professional military man.
Well, of course, you know, we had a lot of changes in the Marine Corps and in service life in general. Right in that area there, you know, Vietnam brought about a lot of changes. You know, the attitude of the people coming into the service were a lot different than they had been previously, and Yeah, it made a difference. You know, I had to treat people differently when I came out of Vietnam. I'd always been a person that, you know, would give an order and by damn, he was going to do it. And you know, I kind of changed relative to that. You know, I didn't give orders with the same in the same manner that I had given them before. I tried to use a little bit of feeling for the individual, and you know, I mean, I still got work done, but I just was not the same way in getting it done. I didn't have to yell and scream at a person. It made me have more feeling for people. Because I saw a lot of people that didn't come back, and you know, I don't know. You know, I had one incident. I had a young man over there. You know, before we got hit, he was just a bird. You know, a yard bird, and I had he was very sloppy in his work, and. And I treated him exactly the way that I, you know, if a man was a bird, I treated him the way he acted. I treated him like dirt. And I was wrong in this particular instance because he's also a human being, but I didn't acknowledge that, you know. And so I took him off of duties. I didn't spend the time with him to teach him his duties properly and make him do a better job or encourage him. And I don't know whether he was mentally capable. It's a possibility he wasn't capable, and it is very tedious and exacting work working in a fire direction center. But anyway, I took the easy way out and made him my flunky. You know, if the captain's jeep needed washing or the oil needed changing or what have you, you know, I would let him do that, all the dirty work. And any of the work details that I had to furnish people for, he was the man I furnished, you know. And I got him out of my hair rather than, you know, then working with him and trying to shape him up to where he could to do the job. And you know, I don't think I'd do that today. I don't think I would treat a person the way I treated him today. And this was another little humorous incident relative to him. Now he came back to the United States for discharge during the siege, and when he came back to the States. After he got discharged, he had a copy of his DD-214 made, and he sent it in the mail to the guys in the unit there, and he put a note on there and said, "Tell the gunny to wash his own goddamn jeep." And so he was a good kid, you know. It was all right. So I learned something. I learned that people are people, or sometimes you have to get in a pretty bad situation before you can figure that out, you know. You know, I mean, we all suffered the same deals there, and you know, they went through it just as well as I did, you know. You know, I can understand a professional going through something like that. I mean, that's what we're paid to do. You know, a kid, you just go out here and take a kid on the street and bring him and put him in something like that, and he does just great, you know. And I think that speaks well for the young people in this country. And I, you know, if they were faced with that situation again, I think they'd react in the same manner. Might be wrong because of the attitude is getting away from things of that nature, and so who knows. But we still have a Marine Corps, and I'm sure they still indoctrinate. Well, I have a son in the Marine Corps today, so I know they indoctrinate him in the same manner, and he's enjoying it.
Let me share an observation that was a surprise to me. The people that we've spoken to while they're in Quezon, these would be the guys who are in just for a single tour and so on. You ask them what kept your morale going and why were you going from day to day, how could you do it? And they'd say basically that they knew that, or they thought they were involved in one of a big chapter in Marine Corps history. And it was important for them to carry through on this. Not that they were American citizens carrying out policy in their country or fighting for the president, but in some cases they were fighting for Bravo Company. or the battalion, or, you know, a smaller, you know, or the Marine Corps, and it's since the past. Anything of that, in terms of morale or spirit, or anything that you could say in relation to Kaysan, that would be very helpful.
Well, you know, I think I mentioned that a little bit earlier about the Esprit de Corps and everything, and that's why I don't think that, you know, people would have wanted to just be pulled out. You know, that's when I was talking about that, because I think that it would be, the basic thought would be for the Marine Corps, you know, not necessarily for the country. I mean, we were there as Marines, we're fighting a battle for our country, but still, it was the U.S. Marine Corps, and I think that's where the morale. I mean, you know, the history of the Marine Corps tells you, and you know, all that's all instilled in us from the day we go in the Marine Corps to the day we get out, and even then on, you know, the saying, "Once a Marine, always a Marine," and. You know, I feel that way today.